curses of modernity. Part of the biggest aspects of fragility is being atomized and alone. Structure, intention, and community. No, one of the big core missions we have is to push back against the atomization, what the long-term play is, and how we are going to see it through to the other side. Mental health services, which are a complete grift psychologically, is resulting in a bunch of dysfunctional individuals. The guidance and camaraderie of the group.
So I have with me today JD Sterker, who is the first official sponsor of the podcast with Axios Fitness. So start, just tell me a little bit about Axios Fitness, which I've been in for a little while now, so I'm familiar with it, but from your word.
Yeah, so Axios is a strength conditioning company. What I provide is effectively my guidance and coaching through various programs and consultation. But the big flagship offering I have is what we call the Axios Training Club, which is a kind of an exclusive community of our guys as we, you know, orient and focus our energy towards building and committing ourselves to taking this thing physical and taking back our health from, you know, the curses of modernity, for lack of a better term.
No, absolutely. There's no better term, I think. I think you're totally right with both our lifestyles and our diets. And diet is something I've brought up several times, is something I still have issues with, I say, as I drink this poison. But yeah, the second sponsor I'm going to look for is a coffee company, which I've talked to someone about. But that's not what this is about. This is about Axios Fitness and you and the need for it and how it benefits people. And this is something I truly believe in. You guys know I wouldn't sell you something that I don't believe in, and I truly believe in this. Who else do you sponsor?
I work with Jay Burden. I work with Blood Satellite, Pete Quinonez and the Pete Quinonez Show.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. And then in talks with a few others, you know, here and there, trying to grow my presence as much as possible. And what I want to do is make sure that I attach my brand and my expertise to different channels and different voices in our side of things that are trying to get the need for a service like this to their audience.
Right.
It's one thing that, you know, there's a financial component to make sure that every podcaster or voice or contributor, in our space, I find ways to make sure that, you know, there's a service that they can be providing that they can benefit from, not only from the training, but also financially, but also getting something that when guys use it, it's physical and real in the sense of building yourself towards something.
Yeah. Yeah. And that something is personalized, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a variety of different ways in which people can take on training. But a piece of that is the individualization and customization that come with it. My background is in sports science and exercise physiology. So I would say I've got, you know, miles deep of information that can help guys. But most guys really need is structure, intention, and community. Those three things.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Those three things tend to be enough to really bring a new habit into being and just shape the way that you kind of commit yourself through the day.
And that for me is so huge, obviously. I've talked to you about that at length before, but not publicly, besides like on the Discord and the Telegram. If you guys aren't in those, join those. I'll put the links below. They always are. But this is a cultural thing, right? When you're talking about building a community, it's a culture within that community. And that level of surrounding yourself with other people that have similar, not the same goals, of course, because it's personalized, has an extraordinarily positive effect on what you're doing. And so that's why, like, when you reached out to me, I was immediately like, I think what I first said was like, hey, we'll talk about the details, but the answer is yes, basically, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, no, it's been, there's something about the physical domain that is inherently our thing. When I say our thing in quotations, like our guys, our space, this thing we're doing, we know that, being healthy and being strong are more than just markers or signals. They are physical actions that are necessary for us to retain who we are in terms of the core of our being functionally, right? But as well as like a kind of a guiding light for the future, for bringing guys on side. You know, it's one thing to just mog on the dysgenics, but, you know, effectively it is an attractive element to pull people in that are looking for something, because without something that's really anchored or justified, you're kind of left with a bit of a cheap narcissism, which I think is all that the current trajectory of health and fitness really only has to offer. Similarly within sports, you know, it's so much of a husk of its former self. No longer is it really anchored to whatever place is on the jersey of the athlete. It's more of just an entertainment apparatus now that is, you know, part of commodifying what, you know, really is just the physical energy that is part of, you know, a people from a place of a time.
Yeah.
That should be used to protect and energize and work towards the future rather than what we have now.
And you see this in like European soccer clubs, right? It's like they're, or well, less so even today, but like the root of these clubs, football clubs, athletic clubs is what they were originally called, is that they would be from an area and have a culture surrounding it, and guys are getting together, working together. And that's just guys together in a community is something that's kind of frowned upon by the general culture. It's viewed as a negative thing today in a lot of ways. But it's something that there's a huge, huge need for. And it's, I love what you're creating. Obviously, I really, really love it. Love what you've created. It's already existing. And I'm really, really happy to be working with you. And this is something that I think everybody can benefit from. And obviously, when your physical attributes and the actions that you're taking, they reflect in your physical appearance, both in like how you carry yourself, grooming, clothing, but also your literal physicality. I mean, that says something to people. And the modern, you know, leftist, whatever you want to call it, the modern mainstream culture, you know, we still have rising obesity rates. They're getting insane, especially amongst the younger generations. It doesn't bode well for us, I don't think. And it's become so standard and so normal to be fat and slovenly. And if you're listening to this and you're fat, like that's not you. That's just a detail of you right now, and you can change that. And I think that the benefits from that are far reaching. It's mind, body, and brain. You know, mind is different from brain in the sense that your brain can be intellectually good, but mentally you're still not strong if you're not, you know, cultivating those, you know, I don't want to get too far into spirituality, but the, you know, your soul, like, and the physicality of what you're doing, it is intertwined with that. And the interconnectedness of these different, I'm getting so esoteric right now, but these things are interconnected. And any spending your time on, you know, physically working on yourself has far, far reaching benefits for everything else. And I think it's one of the greatest things that you can do to increase your efficiency, your contentedness, your happiness, your strength of mind as well as body.
Yeah, no, they're tied, so. But they're also echoes, right? They're all echoes of a similar concept that sits at it. And it's fundamentally, are you going to be responsible for how you respond to the environment around you, right? Mm-hmm. One way that I've framed, you know, I just consider it kind of the dysgenic mainstream consensus, is that it encourages a sense of passivity, right? There is no, you have to accept the trust of the bureaucratic expert class, which makes its way into something like a food pyramid, which if you look at the consequences of such maneuvering has been the, you know, these rise in obesity rates, rise in diabetes rates, you know, the overall just degradation of a people, because we've given over the justification of what is healthy to, you know, really a, you know, it's a group of faceless suits around a board who put together, you know, they're open to the whoever's going to lobby them the most, and who's going to subsidize what food products can also, you know, be treated with, you know, chemically laced fertilizers and all these things that all are kind of tied to this larger corporate demand for the line going up. But I digress.
The homogenization of everything, which
right. I mean, even down to the categories system. Yeah. The same thing that's used to, you know, clean the machines is the same thing that they're using to make sure your food can stay on the shelf for, you know, 12 months out of the year and not change an ounce. My biggest struggles are with the inability of the modern man to not see the writing on the wall and not desire to make a change. Specifically within themselves, right? To reject the garbage that sits there, to start forming bonds with other men and start working towards becoming stronger and revitalizing a sense of this martial spirit that was once there.
Yeah, 100%. You brought up the bureaucracy earlier, and that bureaucracy, like, and it does affect, it's got this Leviathan has its tentacles into everything. But there is this idea in the mainstream amongst everyone that other people are going to fix your problem. If you are experiencing violence from someone else or the threat of violence, a lot of people today, the idea that, you know, gun control is like a separate thing, but it is connected in a way that the underlying belief of people not having guns is that they're like, oh, you don't need to protect yourself. You just call the police. But, you know, that's what's going on right now. And like, I'm not one of these apocalyptic minded people, but, you know, complex systems theory and how just in how things can get bad very quickly. And you need to have a level of physicality to be able to deal with unforeseen things. Even before an apocalyptic scenario, you can find yourself in a situation where your physical health, a natural disaster, a one-off situation where you're somewhere and someone is threatening you or your loved ones, it's something that's very important to be able to handle yourself. This self-responsibility that used to be standard to American culture, frontierism, and being able to handle your own problems. And we have lost that. And at least in smaller communities and culture, it's something that I think that individuals should be trying to regain and to surround themselves with other people who have a similar mindset, because that is having other people that share a similar mindset is going to push you harder. Like I was saying this to you off the air, but the social pressure of being in this group now for a little while, it's not just me that I'm letting down if I don't do my work. There's a change in mindset where, like, if I'm not working out, if I'm not taking care of myself, I implicitly understand that might affect my loved ones. But it's also that the other people in this community, when there's standards for how you should act, in this case, just, you know, doing your workouts, and then you're not doing your workouts, I'm not only letting down myself, but I'm letting down everyone else in that community. And that social pressure is something that really affects me personally. I think that that's a normal human thing. And I think that you should work to understand that human instinct and make changes in your life as a result of that. And in this case, it means that I really do think that you should sign up with JD. I really believe it.
No, one of the big core missions we have is to kind of push back against the atomization that's hit us all. You know, to the point on you're saying there is that, you know, there's an inherent fragility that seems to be incentivized. And part of the biggest aspects of fragility is being atomized and alone. What I wanted to do with this was not only just offer, you know, the level of knowledge that I have so that I can help guys handle their individual needs, but also then to re-communalize our side of things, so that every ounce of work you put towards this thing isn't just something that is energy for yourself. It's connected to a larger, you know, a larger organism in and of itself. Your victories are now the group's victories. And, you know, despite where you may start, so long as you are working towards building yourself to becoming stronger, that is what, you know, unifies the group. And, you know, we can gang up towards success together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it is personalized again. So like, you know, I've had some struggles trying to get this started based on my travel and everything. But as it's happened, I've like worked out a way that works for me in addition to having personalized workouts that work for me. Like, you know, I bought certain things and set up places, and because I split my time in multiple places. I even changed my travel schedule because I realized like, no, I need to be concentrating on this. I need to, like, if I'm going to travel, I need to, you know, do that with the understanding that I also need to be working on my body. And that's something that I've been letting go to the wayside for so long, because I've been concentrating so much on this one aspect of my life, which is the work that I'm doing, that I let everything else fall to the wayside, to use the same phrase I said. Can you expand on what you mean by atomization?
Yeah. So, you know, we have this kind of running concept of the individual, and the individual is, you know, cherished. It's kind of a sacred concept. Certainly in the, you know, say post 1945 worldview that we've inherited. But with atomization is kind of an either further construct where you actually have no bounds, duties, or obligations to anything other than kind of the smallest domain of your own pursuit of subjective importance. If that, you know, if that lines up with kind of where you're at, I see it as the kind of a corrosive acid concept that has been applied over the long enough time that is, it's inherently emotional in that sense. It elevates emotions above what would be provided duties from outside yourself, which, you know, in my trajectory of things, I found that the things that they're actually undecided probably are the most important things ever, right? You don't get to decide who your parents are. You don't decide your family. You don't decide your community. You don't decide where you're born, but you are given a chance to be responsible for that time and place and to address the, you know, the poisons or the ills that are effectively being pumped into it at the moment.
Yeah, 100%. We've talked about this on the podcast before. This hyper-individualism, which in the modern West and specifically the United States is, it's very new and it's very different from even the rest of the world right now. And personally, the way I feel is that this hyper-individualism is not good for the individual, because humans are Homo sapiens are social creatures. You can compare this to like Neanderthals that, based on archaeological evidence, and I won't go into the details. Other people have heard this if they listen to the show. They were Neanderthals were they operated in more solo, maybe smaller groups, a family group, rather than these larger bands of Homo sapiens, and eventually that came to replace them. So Homo sapiens are collective creatures. We are collective creatures, and most of the world still is like this. It's a complete deviation from human nature that we're in this position where we're hyper individual. And I'm going to choose my words carefully on this, but an example that I have, if people are familiar with Mr. Beast, he's the number one YouTuber. He makes content for people younger than you and I, really, but I watch every single one of his videos because they're like 20 minutes long at most, and he comes out with one every few weeks, and you know, they're designed for the algorithm. They're designed just scientifically to just keep as many people watching as possible. And his explicit goal is to be the most popular YouTube channel ever, which he has created. And now he just wants to keep going. So Chris is now transgender, transitioning, HRT therapy, left his wife and his child. And from an individual standpoint, you know, if you want to be an individual, that is fine. So Chris leaves his wife and child and transitions to a woman, or is in the process of transitioning to a woman. I mean, Chris killed this kid's father, basically. Like, the father no longer exists. He fathered a child. He was in this collective relationship, this duty that he had to his wife and to his child. And I say his in the past tense. And then becomes transgender, and now effectively this child has no father, and there's literal there's posts about this on social media of apparently the kid is like, where's dad? Where's dad? It's like, your dad's gone. Your dad doesn't exist anymore and you don't have one. And it's not through some tragic accident. It's through this culture that promotes the idea of the individual over the collective. And that as an idea, promoting the individual over the collective, and in this case, the collective being the people that should matter the most to you, your wife and your child or other familiar relationships, is truly, truly terrifying to me. And it's awful for everybody involved. And there's other examples of this in our culture, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's terribly dark. Goodness. Yeah,
and it made me think about this in a new way, because it's, you know, if you're a kid and, you know, you Decepticon yourself, then like, maybe that's not great for your parents, depending on what they're like. Maybe they're like the Hollywood people that buy kids from Africa and you know, do what they want with them and make them parade around in dresses, Charlize Theron. But it's, yeah, that's all I got to say on it. It's bad. It's very, very bad. It's, and it's selfish. It's inherently selfish. And I think some people, not anyone that listens to this, but some people in the general culture would view it as like, oh, but the individual, like this person is living their truth and whatever. It's like, yeah, that's great. But what about the other people that they had ties to that, they're harming with their actions?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, a very simple way, I live in an area where I have many, many people are normies and they don't think about these things past the surface level. And one method in trying to get this information across to somebody that maybe is unwilling to entertain it is, would you do this to your enemies? Because what's happening, everything you just described there is something that I can only see as a foreign enemy doing to a population that they want to destroy.
Yeah.
Everything about that is the end of anything that can continue. There's now a child that doesn't have a father to guide him. There's now a father that's not there, that's spiritually dead and on his way to physical death, in the sense that he's just a hormone treatment. Yeah, all he is just a pharmaceutical pay pig at this point. For him to keep playing this little game that he's doing, he has to keep paying the pharmaceutical company to give him what he needs so that we can all participate in this little lie. And
it's the opposite of self-reliance at that point, because
absolutely,
it's completely propped up by this specific hyper individualistic and hyper modern idea.
Yeah. The only thing that gets accomplished is that a man is no longer a man that can defend his family. A child doesn't have a father to guide him, and a pharmaceutical company gets a paycheck. That's all that's achieved.
Yeah. A big paycheck. I think I've seen estimates at like $1 million per person to the pharmaceutical, well, to the medical industry in general.
Mm-hmm.
But it's promoted. So yeah, we started off real dark there. That's But that is,
we're in it. Yeah, it is the trajectory we're on, though. These are the things we have to contend with. And these are the psychological struggles that we have to try and navigate. And the real energy falls on us is to remain disciplined in these moments, because something like that, I mean, I think whatever visceral response you have to circumstances like that, they're justified. But we have to really think through what the long-term play is and how we are going to see it through to the other side.
Yeah.
This ahead. This ties to the atomization part, is that if you're atomized and you feel this way, that's one of the worst places to be, because you have no one to talk to about what you're seeing. Because if you have any sort of negative response to this, you're just going to have to sit with it and let it burn. And you know, I operating in the fitness space, you see all of this rise in these different, let's call it mental health services, which are a complete grift, because none of them actually address the true issues, which are the atomization is occurring because no one's allowed to push against the current incentives. Because if you do, you become depersoned, you become debanked, you know, there's no yard sign for what what we can stand for and how we can try and form bonds. So you have these mental health, say, these avenues that call themselves mental health. Like, that's kind of just the vector point that they approach, because it's unavoidable that the psychological impacts of the modern world that we're living in basically encourages a state of schizophrenia, right? If you're a modern lib, your values are going to change with the wind. And what you were willing to die for yesterday is going to be completely different, if anything, contradictory tomorrow. But you have to wear it with a smile and keep going as you constantly try and frame yourself as the good person that says the good things and not one of the bad people that constantly changes with whoever is, you know, the acceptable target of the day.
Right. Yeah. And this is what creates the doublethink that promotes, you know, people that love both. And I don't want to get into the politics of this too much. It's not the topic, but promoting, like, you know, it should be cognitive dissonance to support both Ukraine and Israel, but it's not. And a lot of people do that, in the sense that they are like similar macro situations.
Well, and add a third variable in is that you can't give the same energy that either of those countries are being given to your own.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So we need to support Ukraine. We need to send them money and guns and weapons to defend themselves. But at the same time, no, you shouldn't have guns to defend yourself. Why do you need that? It's like, well, what about what you're doing over there? The inherent nationalism in the defense of Ukraine, whereas American nationalism is viewed negatively by the mainstream. So you guys know that I was in the Marine Corps. I talk about it every once in a while on the podcast. And something that I remember, I remember having in specific situations, I had both on deployment when I'm on this ship, I'm on this naval ship for 7 months, and in boot camp, you know, and I'm part of a collective, a very literal collective, a harsh collective, everybody looks the same, you know, obviously we're different races, heights, and genders, but we all wear the same uniform. We are given our jobs. We're told what we have to do. You know where you stand, and you can't deviate from that because it's literally illegal and you'll go to jail. And, you know, there are situations where if I was given the opportunity to quit, I would have quit. There are times, and I think everybody, when they go to boot camp, they have situations where they're like, I got to get out of this. I got to quit. You know, you're in your rack at night and you're like, I got to figure out in the morning a way to get out of this. And maybe if I was given the opportunity, like in BUDS, which is way harder than Marine Corps boot camp, I'm not trying to compare them in that sense. You end up in a situation where, like, if you could ring the bell and quit, you're going to quit, but you can't. They don't let you quit in Marine Corps boot camp. You basically have to say you're going to unalive yourself and they'll take you out of there. Not immediately. It'll take a while, but you can get out. And when this happened to me in boot camp, when I had this thought, I remember one specific time I woke up the next morning and I was like, oh no, I just needed to sleep. I'm good. I want to be here. This is what I'm going to do. On deployment, you know, I'm on this ship in the middle of the ocean having a little bit of a crisis and it's like, oh, I got to get out of here. And it's like, oh, there's no escape from this. This is what I have to do. And I think that when you're in that situation where, based on the collective around you, you're essentially forced to continue what you're doing and there might be a way out of it, but it's a really hard way out of it, then you accept that situation and you find a way to deal with it. But when you're given an easy out in any situation in your life, when there is culturally accepted ways of getting an easy out, and another example of this, I'm thinking of the decline of shotgun marriages and the decline of fathers being, right, you know, required to take care of their children, and that gets into abortion and that being accepted. So like, oh, if you get a woman pregnant, it's like, oh, you know what, whatever, it's fine if you don't take care of your kids. But in my perspective, a man that doesn't take care of his children or his wife should be, you know, shown social ridicule to the point of not being able to do anything else. But that's not the case. There are there's, you know, famous people who are trying not to take care of their own children, and it's accepted in our culture. And when people are given these outs, they will take them. And another example, just for a third example to really hammer this in, like in India, they have arranged marriages. They also have much lower divorce rates, and they have much higher rates of marital satisfaction. And I really, really believe that this has to do with the acceptability of divorce in the United States and the acceptability of not having to take care of your children. It's not, there isn't enough social control that promotes that. So, this is a thing, shout out Bogbeat, but bring back shotgun marriages. I think that we should live in a society where people are required in a very literal sense to honor their commitments and to honor the commitments of marriage that they made before God. But when you live in a situation and when you live in a culture that accepts this and you do have an easy out, because like, you know, I could have gotten out of the military early if I said the right thing or did the right thing. I didn't. I finished my contract. But if I were to get out, I mean, it would be viewed dishonorably by people that this is important to, both for my military family and also for other veterans. They look down, you know, to varying degrees, depending on the situation, on people who aren't willing to stick it out. It's very negative. And those types of social control, you should surround yourself with types of social control that promote you to do the things that you have to do and have the mindset of honoring your commitments and doing what you have to do. So I talked a lot, but does that make sense?
No, that all sits well. I mean, that's the bedrock of having a culture that is for you and not against you, right? Not to mention the mild reflection of the culture of the West as well. And I think a big piece that we're running into is that the ability to impose a state of consequences for breaking the culture, right? Or the culture that we've inherited, the culture we wish we inherited, at least. Those consequences are made illegal. In fact, the consequences are effectively flipped, right? You shame the people that have fundamentalist beliefs around the concepts that you just espoused. They're seen as backwards. They're seen as low. It's, a complete inversion of what, effectively where we came from, I would say,
right,
in terms of trying to find a way to, order and organize a sense of responsibility around things as large as commitment to marriage and seeing through your responsibilities as a father. Like now, one easy way to look at it is in the past is that if the daughter, if a young girl, right, say 18, got pregnant and the father failed, well, the brothers of that sister would track him down and beat his ass. Simple as that.
Right.
And that's acceptable. That's good that they did that because, there needs to be necessary components. These are the consequences that are natural to human order, natural to the state of how we see a sense of social hygiene as well. But we don't occupy that time. We occupy a therapeutic managerial state, right? That's is that Gottfried's term, I believe, but it's absolutely correct. Now, if anything happens, anything that happens now, it's seen as something that needs to be treated, right? It needs to be addressed by that same bureaucratic element. Like the reason that this goes back to the concepts of these mental health grifts that emerge, right? They're an absolute child of this therapeutic managerial mindset. Whereas, instead of trying to address the reasons that you feel anxiety, address the reasons that you feel depressed. The anxiousness and depression just need to be managed. They just need to be either treated from a form of meditation. You sit back and you just reflect and let the emotions roll over you. Or, fundamentally, it pipelines you towards more pharmaceutical intervention. Whereas the anxiety and the depression, these are natural. You should be feeling these things if you are atomized. You should be feeling these things if the surrounding areas that you're in are becoming more and more violent, are becoming more and more non-distinct from anybody that you share values with. It's it's wild to think that, you know, you can, the mental health grift is one of those things that's like, it's pure liberal cognitive dissonance just packaged and sold to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, like, you know, I'm pretty critical of therapy as well. I think there are certain elements that are good and those have kind of been co-opted. I tend to believe in the idea of cognitive behavioral therapy, but if you're getting cognitive behavioral therapy, and that is a type of therapy that changes the way that you're thinking, that can be applied in such a way, especially in conjunction with pharmaceuticals, that you then accept these things that are not acceptable or should not be acceptable. And that's not good. It gets you to accept things that are bad. It gets you to accept this dink, double income, no kids, this, you know, your value in life should come from having your time to play video games and go out to happy hours. And that's empty.
It's just pain avoidance. Yes. Right. I mean, it's a cultural incentive so that you just feel pain, but try and dumb it down and hide from it rather than actually learn from it, rather than actually try and, you know, get to the root cause, do something that is to the core. Pain is a signal that something is wrong.
If you stick your hand onto a hot iron, if you grab a hot iron, if you've sprayed numbing gel on your hand, which is the physical counterpart to these types of therapy and pharmaceutical medications, which I'm not going to say they're bad in all cases, just because, you know, I don't know everyone's personal situation. I'm not inside your head, but they can be used in a way where you grab a hot iron and your body is telling you, let go of that. But if you've numbed your hand to where you're not feeling that pain, you're like, whatever, I'm just holding this hot iron, it's fine. And then your hand is destroyed from the burning. And that's what a lot of people are doing to their mind by going someplace where someone is affirming your negative beliefs, because they've been trained to these negative beliefs that are going to continue to destroy your life, even if you've numbed yourself from the real consequences.
Yeah, there's definitely a time and a place for such, you know, what they need to be treated as nuclear options, right? These are large scale treatments for neurological, like neurophysiological needs for whatever reason. But there's nothing wrong with a sense of skepticism as the start. And I think that would be the position I would advocate for, is that we've lost a healthy skepticism of the level of these top-down ameliorations to our problems. And part of that is because they don't want you to have the natural intuitive response, to, you know, your neighborhood dissolving into a criminal neighborhood. That destroys their grift, is if you lean into that intuition. Not only that, it showcases that they potentially have some liability in this as well.
Right.
One thing that I would say, that I'm an optimist for the future, but, you know, through a long track of pessimism that we have to get through. That makes sense.
Yeah. Things will get worse before they get better.
Yes. And we need to be strong enough to handle how bad things can get naturally. But should we accomplish that mission, things can become very good. What needs to happen at this point in time, you know, going back to the transformer issue that you listed earlier, is we're at a point that's pretty close where people should be starting to look at these gender affirming care treatments and holding them liable for what they've done.
So I will tell you that where I've looked at the statistics, the acceptability of these things has actually gone down over the last 5 to 10 years. It went up for a long time, but it's been slowly decreasing in acceptability across most demographics, I think.
Right.
And psychographics.
And the next piece is to just not just make it unacceptable, but to fundamentally push for those that allowed it to be acceptable or advocated for its rapid growth to face harsh punishment as much as you can get, because of what they've grifted off of the innocence of your children. They've played, again, into this realm of virtue signaling, knowing full well that this was a short-term thing, that they could manipulate the, what would it be, the acceptability rate, right?
Yeah.
That was the only thing they use as a marker for good or evil, is whether or not you smiled and nodded with what they were trying to promote.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I forget who this is rooted in, but the term "it's all one thing" has been thrown around quite a bit recently. I wish I remembered who specifically that originated with, but these types of things are interconnected. Like the people that run pharmaceutical companies are the same people that run other large companies. And it's no secret that the pharmaceutical companies are criminal organizations. The amount of things that they've been, even if you don't believe in like when I think of criminal, I'm talking about from a literal sense, like even if something is morally and ethically a cesspool, which I fully believe personally, this thing that we're talking about is, there's also the level of like just the of it not maybe being criminalized in a literal sense, as in being prosecuted in court. But these same pharmaceutical companies that are, and other medical companies that are promoting these types of things, they have been found to be criminally liable in an extraordinarily large number of other cases. You can look these cases up yourself. I'm not going to talk about them specifically, but the things that they've been found guilty of in corporate courts is huge. But there are two problems, which is that there is no personal responsibility on the individuals that act as the agents of these large conglomerate multinational corporations. And number two, there isn't even enough downside to use a financial example from the financial sector. There are plenty of examples of financial companies, for example, like I forget which specific large bank this was, but there was a bank that was working specifically with Mexican cartels and with, I think one of them with ISIS, don't quote me on that one, with Mexican cartels, definitely. And with
HSBC.
HSBC, okay. And somebody was working with Epstein as well, even after his first arrest somewhere around like 2006. Sure. So, you know, these things are being funded, and those, there are no personal consequences to the individuals acting as agents of these corporations, which, by the way, they're organized, they're designed to reduce your liability as an individual. I own an LLC that is designed to limit my liability in relation to my companies. And that is limited liability, and that's fine in certain cases. I think it's good for promoting a business so that if something happens with one of the businesses you own, you don't lose everything. I get that. But at the same time, there needs to be a balance in that, and we don't have that currently. And in the case of the financial crimes, there have been frauds that have been committed, people very, very literally taking actions that are technically illegal and then technically found guilty. But when you are in a case where when you're in a situation where the punishment for these crimes, which in many cases this is true, the punishment for them in courts is actually less than the money that you make, and the personal consequences are non-existent. For example, in 2008, only one guy, some poor Asian schmuck, and I'm calling him a schmuck based on the way he's treated, not because he's Asian or because of who he was. One guy went to prison, and he wasn't even in Manhattan. He was in New Jersey. He barely did anything, and they picked him out and threw him in prison because he didn't have the power to not go to prison from the real criminals that caused this type of thing. And that incentive structure promotes more of that behavior. It's when people look at a balance sheet and they see that they can take a certain action which is going to destroy people's lives and is technically illegal, they're going to do it anyway if they know that the consequences are lower for the company than what you're going to be charged in court, and that those individuals will not get punishment for it, which they won't, as we've seen. One other thing I wanted to say. Well, every time. Mine's a jungle. 3M. This is a thing that personally affected me. I have hearing loss, again, from the Marine Corps. And 3M actually sold earplugs that they knew were defective. There's recordings of their boardroom or wherever it was talking about this, and emails, I think, where they talked about how they knew these things didn't work well, but they had already manufactured so many of them that they're like, well, we're not going to receive that much of a punishment for it, so we won't do it. So we're not going to fix this. We're going to send them out. Maybe we'll go to court eventually when we get caught out, when we get caught. But the punishment for that was nothing. The punishment was lower than how much money they made off of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, and what's happened as a result of that is those people that got hearing loss as a result of that is now, that loss is now socialized, not even including the people like me that have hearing loss and tinnitus as a result of these faulty earplugs, but also that's the human cost of it. That's intangible. I mean, what price can you put on your hearing? But it's those losses are now, they now come out of the Department of Defense budget, and it comes from tax dollars, federal tax dollars that go towards paying people disability payments. And that does not go to 3M as maybe it should. And if we lived in a culture that did that, we wouldn't have companies acting like this if the consequences were real. And that is just like all these other things that we just talked about. There's no consequences for not taking care of your children or your wife.
No.
Or divorcing. Also women as well, not just men.
Yeah.
Usually I'm talking crap about women, not men. So this is different.
Yeah. No, and then you end up with even just more dysgenic leftists as well, because there's this interesting framing here where we can all hate the corporations, but you know, we do anything along this lines of the conversation we're having here, where we start looking at the cultural imperative that you curtail something like that from happening again. And it gets pivoted and framed as you being part of this, you know, international socialist class, which is an annoying conversation always to have. But I wonder how much of that is also just a, you know, it's the unique little dialectic that just keeps moving everything in a similar direction. Because the dysgenic leftists definitely are they're an energy source for this thing that we have here. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not one to go into the details on that. There's people with far more astute observations than I do, but it's definitely a tricky conundrum to be in, because we're set into this little jousting match that both sides tend to not have your best interest at heart.
Yeah. When you say both sides, can you expand on that?
Oh, I would say between the, what's the way to put it?
I mean, is it Republicans and Democrats?
No, I'd say, I mean, that's one framing, but that's not truly it, because
right.
Both of them are still kind of this liberal conception, right? How often do you see this right-leaning side constantly bending over backwards to showcase how it's the real liberal party? Right?
Yeah, 100%.
It accepts the frames and values of its opponent, and just constantly, it's just a rear guard action, right? I believe is the term.
They want to go back to the 1990s.
Yeah, and they'll be saying the same thing about trying to go back to the 2010s, you know, however this goes, you know, it's all, again, we're back to this dark topic yet again. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, I would go back to the 1990s if I knew it would stay, but the 90s led to what we have now. So it obviously didn't work. But you can't say that, because you can't say that you want to repeal the Civil Rights Act and still have a normal job. You know, I can say it, and I will say it. We need to repeal the Civil Rights Act. But, you know, for a lot of other people that need to exist in normal society, unlike me, they just can't say it. And when things are left unsaid that need to be said, eventually things come to a breaking point. I don't think anybody wants that, because when things come to a breaking point, you inevitably have violence, which is something that I don't want. And I'm not saying that as somebody who's going to be practicing violence, because I'm not. I say it all the time. I'm a man of the pen, not the sword. But but that's the way I see it. That's the way I see it going based on my study of history.
Going back to this mental health grift, I know that I've harped on it before, but it showcases like this level of, you know, playing this game psychologically is resulting in a bunch of dysfunctional individuals that don't know how to operate in any way that is healthy or capable.
And it also kind of frames the metrics to where they're saying that what we would call dysfunctional is actually not dysfunctional. Oh, it's great that all you do is eat Taco Bell and drink and play video games. That's fine. You're 29. Who cares?
Right. And that autonomous nature that is promoted and celebrated now latches onto this dysfunction and demands that you celebrate the dysfunction.
Right. Really,
and so we just end up in a feedback loop that just encourages more and doesn't do anything to self-correct. But I mean, that's
again,
the reason why
that will come to a head.
Yeah, and you know, you see people go through, you know, psychological episodes, and it's really the question is why aren't more people doing it, right? But I think that frames what we're doing nicely, because we are inherently kind of the white blood cells to the system. We're the immune system trying to self-correct and heal the organism. Whereas much of what's happening around us is kind of an autoimmune disorder. It's taking those natural responses and turning it inward against the organism itself as it kind of erodes, which is why everything kind of seems like it's on a self-degrading suicide mission, right? Against itself. You know, institutions don't, you know, they're not following through on what you would assume the telos of a university would be. Instead, it's about complete self-destruction and self-immolation.
Right. And the universities are, you know, they're part of a bigger whole. Like people, obviously these universities are separate, but there's a decentralized in a certain way force that promotes certain ideas and pushes down others. And in this podcast, we've talked about this in the context of specifically anthropology. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of examples of that in this field. But at a higher level, you know, there is a hierarchical diffusion, and cultural diffusion is this idea of top-down culture. And in the context of universities, that is extraordinarily common. That's how these things work, because the professors at the top universities, they're setting the stage, and the students at the top universities, I'm saying this like in quotes, because I don't actually think they're great. I think they suck now. But the actions of the top universities, you see these protests break out at Yale, Harvard, and Columbia. And then after that, you see them break out in other places, like the University of Connecticut, where there's protests right now. We talked about this the other night on 5 Till Midnight. But the ideas that are in the tops of these universities, and the people that are deciding the funding for colleges, they're behind the scenes, and this is kind of hidden, but if you look, it's not really that hidden. The individuals, there's gatekeepers that stop certain ideas from getting in. And this is a situation that we're coming to today where this has increased in purity over time towards conservative, even self-identified conservative professors are extinct almost, especially in places like New England and the Pacific Northwest. I've looked at statistics on this. I've talked about this in early episodes. You can go back. How education was designed to make you dumb. Maybe it was the episode. It's one of my very early episodes. But this is what happens. And people cannot move up in these institutions if they don't think a certain way. And sometimes the people that are in these institutions, they don't really recognize it even, because maybe that's how they truly believe, and they're not actively thinking about it. And then there's other people who actively understand it, and then through rent-seeking behavior and through, excuse me, agreeableness, mm-hmm. which is a feminine trait, by the way. I'm one of the most disagreeable people you'll ever meet. It produces homogeneity, which is not what you want, and it's not the root of academia,
right?
At all, or of a culture that claims to promote diversity, but really just wants a multicolored coalition of people that all think the same neoliberal, neoconservative BS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's inherently non-competitive. And it the way that it defeats competing ideas is just through effectively not allowing them to play the game.
Right.
And this is very much kind of, this seems to be the playbook across all these different institutions. It's the, you know, that's liberal imperialism as best as you can frame it, is to just own the map and not even allow a competitive idea to take root anywhere. And you effectively incentivize social engineering from the top down, but also kind of a self social engineering by looking at the, I mean, that's what I think like the yard sign morality is, like in this house we believe type stuff. It's a form of self-social engineering, like very much in line with like World of the Workers Unite, in the, you put the sign in the window to show that you're part of the, I mean, a lot of it is just, you need to be signaling that you're part of the thing. Whether or not you've actually thought about what's on the sign doesn't matter. It's just making sure that you showcase that you know what team you're on, and that you're going to play by the rules and be very well domesticated in that.
And in the most vapid ways possible, in the most meaningless ways possible. Like my neighbor, I'm blessed to live in a nice suburban neighborhood. My neighbor is a lawyer and he has one of these signs outside of his house, but like he's a lawyer. I don't know. Maybe he does other stuff, but it's all surface level. It's, you know, I talk a lot about Native American issues, even contemporarily. And there's a couple examples I want to bring up in the context of this. I'm sorry, unless you had something else to say on that. I might have interrupted.
No, please go on.
So there's two cases here. My Twitter is down right now. Hopefully it'll be back up by the time this episode is out. But I wrote an article. I wrote a short piece, a long form post on Twitter about the situation with the Land of Lakes woman, commonly called the Butter Maiden, right? You familiar with the Land of Lakes? They used to have a woman on the box. Now it's just whatever.
This is like the Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben's rights, same playbook.
So this situation, though, is so literal. It's absolutely so literal in this case. So the Land of Lakes box was created with art from a Native American artist who was also a World War II Navy veteran. And Land O'Lakes, which is a Minnesota-based company originally, that's why it's called Land O'Lakes, they commissioned him to produce a piece. And what they produced was a woman, a Native American woman, in traditional Native American clothes in front of this beautiful landscape, which is representative of Minnesota. But what people don't realize is that not only is it a traditional Native American woman, it's been called a stereotype in this image of a butter maiden has been called a butter maiden, which is already slanderous. But the image of her has been called a stereotype, which it isn't. It's actually a portrait of a specific Native American woman. Actually, it might not be a specific Native American woman. Mia is the name of the woman. I don't remember if she's based on a real person, but her clothes are not a stereotype. Her clothes are traditional Ojibwe clothes. There's this thing in modern culture where Native Americans are very homogenized in a lot of ways. And like to across the board, like Native Americans are all the same. Whereas really the diversity amongst Native Americans in the United States is massive in subsistence strategies. It's huge. The difference between the Navajo and the Eastern Algonquins and the Tlingit in the Pacific Northwest and the Haida, they're massive. They do everything completely differently. Their languages are as different as Chinese is from English. Like there are many, there's like a dozen language families. I don't know, give or take, there's a lot of language families in North America. Like Indo-European is one language family. And then there's like a dozen language families. So we speak an Indo-European language, which is English. And then the only countries in Europe that aren't is like Finland and Hungary. They're like Altaic or Siberian languages because they came from out there. But the Ojibwe woman on this box, she's dressed in traditional Ojibwe clothes and the land is traditional Ojibwe land. So this is a literal representation done by a Native American Ojibwe artist. And not only that, but the guy's son was out there writing articles being like, hey, guys, why did you take the Butter Maiden? Why did you take Mia off the box? And what Land O'Lakes did was, number one, they ignored the guy's son and they took the Indian and they kept the land. And that's supposed to be progressive, which it isn't. It's awful. And it's homogenization of the culture. And it's this base level of understanding and virtue signaling of what it is. They're not concerned about the actuality of things. They're concerned about the optics of it. The second example, and I'll be more brief in this one, is Ben and Jerry's. Ben and Jerry's, progressive Vermont company, right? These Vermont in New England is known for being the place of crunchy white people. Burlington, Vermont, Bernie Sanders, who I actually have a pretty positive view of Bernie Sanders, mostly because Bernie Sanders is like pre the race communism BS. Bernie Sanders was talking about white people that were disenfranchised in 2016. Most people ignored it, but he was. And I can bring up examples of this. I don't think he's the best thing, but I don't think he's that bad. But Ben and Jerry's talked about, they did a land acknowledgement. They said, oh, we're on stolen land and everything. So the local Native American tribe, which is still around, whose land they were saying they stole, like, and I'm not saying they didn't steal it. I mean, I don't think they stole it. They conquered it, right? But regardless, Ben and Jerry says they stole the land. We're on this stolen land. The Native Americans of that area, the literal ones, not some random Navajo or Apache from out west, but the actual ones whose land that was in the past, they reached out to Ben and Jerry and they're like, hey guys, like, I know you're not going to give us your entire thing, but let's talk about this. Let's have a discussion. And maybe there's something you can do for us. And they didn't even respond the last time I checked to this thing. So it's all, even what they claim to do is faked. It's virtue signaling to the worst possible extent, because they're faking caring and they're doing nothing of actual substance. Or in the case of the woman, the Land O'Lakes box, they're actually taking away what was a real representation of a specific Native American tribe. And as somebody who cares deeply about contemporary Native American issues, this is extraordinarily offensive to me. And no one really seems to care, or at least the right people don't care.
Yeah. Well, yeah. On all sides of this issue, you're surrounded by people that are looking to just take advantage of emotional guilt.
And the social capital.
That's kind of, and the social capital as well. Yeah. That's kind of all you're left with at the end of the day. They're burning everything around themselves, one, so that, you know, you can virtue signal to the people around you to say that you're saying the right thing. And then you've got this, you know, even to whatever tribes say they do have claim, how much of them are, you know, shared bloodlines now with European heritage?
Yeah. And so, and that does get a little murky, but yeah.
So it's this blood and soil. You're allowed to play blood and soil for a certain percentage of your, you know, racial heritage, only at the expense of the other part of your racial heritage. And, you know, it's all just chasing these just corrupt incentives, right? And somebody had something the other day that was talking about, like, the numbers of Native Americans have remarkably boosted because of the number of people saying that they are. Because all the incentives are to say that you are. I mean, all of this is just a game of illusions, and it renders all of these things completely null and void.
Mm-hmm. And like, what's her name, who Trump called Pocahontas, Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah,
right. Like, she literally did. We don't really know for sure if she would have gotten in otherwise, but she did claim Native American heritage. And when that was happening, I was still in my undergrad. And I remember in an anthropology class, people recognized what Elizabeth Warren had done as extraordinarily wrong, because she's somebody who didn't deal with the negative aspects of being a Native American, of the, like, I'm not going to get into it too much, but living on reservations, most of them is extraordinarily bad. They're by any metric, extraordinarily poor, low opportunity, high rates, of drug abuse and these other things that are poisonous to a society. And she claimed this and got benefits from it without actually having experienced those negatives. You see a lot of that today, a lot of that today. But then in popular culture, Trump calls her Pocahontas and people are like acting like this is something that's offensive to Native Americans. No, it's offensive that she claimed this heritage that she shouldn't have. That's the real offensive thing. But again, it's just this surface level crap that's promoted by this vapid neoliberal GAE, whatever you want to call it, that on the surface promotes the most basic forms of social justice and pretends that everything is a human right, while at the same time, their actual actions are just promoting quarterly profits.
And a suicidal view of European heritage as well. Mm-hmm. Right. That's the other side of the coin, is that if you're playing this game where you're trying to get rewarded for claiming some sort of percentage of the other side at the expense of the other percentage that you carry, I mean, that showcases that it's not the side that is being rewarded. It's the side that's being Absolutely. Punished and used as a exchange, right?
Right.
So,
right. And it ends up being the people that are least affected by these types of things that benefit from them. So, for example, I'm sorry, were you going again? I'm really bad about
no,
it.
No, no, no. You're solid. I think the point you're making is that Elizabeth Warren wasn't having any fist fights with a bunch of, you know, kids in the reservation to, you know, stake her claim. She's as far
She didn't grow up on a reservation.
Well, and is as far removed as possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
To the point where she can use low-class whites as a stepping stool and just burn them at the stake for the benefit of her own claims and virtue signals, right? And that's
right.
What you're seeing more and more of. It's drifting into all different avenues of social spheres.
Yeah. And on that topic, there's this thing. Are you familiar with Neobactrian, Basil?
I am. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Love him. He's hilarious. So the people that actually benefit from, I'm sympathetic to the idea that if you grow up on the Navajo reservation, which it's a massive reservation in Arizona, it's huge. I think the last time I checked, their median income was something like $18,000. It's as poor as any other place. There's no opportunity there. If you're a Pequot in Connecticut, you're related. You're in an area where there's other opportunity off the reservation, but you got to drive hours to get somewhere. You got to drive hours to Scottsdale to have opportunity. You have to leave your culture to do it. And the people that end up benefiting from these things are always the people that are they have the most benefits in other ways. So for example, to use college, I did a statistical analysis, a very basic statistical analysis of the demographics of people that, of Black people. So there's essentially two classes of Black people in the U.S. There's two different types. There's, in anthropological terms, there's African American, which is to say it's African American has a lot of admixture of European DNA in it. That's why Black people in America are generally much lighter than actual Bantu Black people in Africa. And they also are, you know, I'm sympathetic to the idea of there being some far-reaching consequences of being an enslaved class in the past. I am sympathetic to that idea. But there's a second class, which is Caribbean and African immigrants. And those people actually have incomes that are in line with, very close to in line with white Americans. And they are heavily overrepresented, these Caribbean and African immigrants. They're getting these slots that are ostensibly created for African Americans who are the descendants of victims of slavery. And they end up getting the benefits of this. They're the ones who, while they're not actually descendants, because they're Black, they're included in this. And that allows this virtue signaling of the university to say, oh, we got all these Black people, and no one looks at the details to say that African Americans are also underrepresented, which, by the way, non-Jewish white people also underrepresented in these colleges. The other example is like someone like AOC. AOC is nearly a 100% European woman. But in the class of her being Hispanic, even though she is a Puerto Rican, literally descended from conquistadors, AOC, who dates a chubby, dysgenic white guy, she is viewed as a person of color, even though you look at her skin and it's the same tone as mine. So besides that, all the other, most of these other people, Ilhan Omar, Rashid Tlaib, almost all of them, Booker, whatever his name is, Cory Booker, they all marry white people. So they're like, they're much more culturally in this white sphere. And they also have more benefits than a normal white person who has very real and very calculable disadvantages in getting into good colleges and getting into a job market that would allow them to get a good job and move up in the world. So it's unfortunate because I am sympathetic to these ideas of people that like, you know, we live in a society, we should uplift people that are actually, you know, that actually have major issues, but that's not even happening. Even what they claim is happening, they claim their reasons for doing it, it's not happening at all. When you look at any of the details, when you spend 5 minutes looking at any of these things, you're like, oh no, they're not helping the descendants of slaves. The inner cities are still completely screwed up, even though there are all these benefits for Black people in the United States. They have access to scholarships and preferential admission into universities and the job market. And even with all that, it actually doesn't help anybody. So you end up just having this multiracial upper class that all believes the same thing and believes their own BS that they push onto everyone else. And then the people that it was supposed to help don't even get helped.
Because the most important thing is just narrative. The most important thing is just narrative control. The problems narrative need to exist. Things. These problems need to remain problems so that you can just only play the narrative game. None of it is, again, they're not about solutions. They never should have a solution. The worst thing to happen to them is to have solutions. Because then you lose the leverage that you have.
And that gets into social constructions and...
Yes.
When I say social, you know...
For sure. Yeah.
They're like... Once you have these positions, like once you have a place like San Francisco, there's like a dozen or two dozen people that are making over $200,000 a year to deal with the homeless crisis that just gets worse. If they solve the homeless crisis, they're out of a job. What are they going to do now? So go ahead.
I said the obesity crisis is the same thing. Mental health crisis, same thing. Everything that gets labeled a crisis now is just a sign that it's a cornerstone of a larger game within the narrative machine. That's all it means.
Yeah. And on university campuses, they're, you know, pushing for mental health resources for students, which then gets passed on to students that are taking out loans to pay these increasing administrative costs at these educational universities, where if they were just what they were before, and there wasn't this tie to the financial industry, which is the real beneficiary of all of this, as well as the colleges themselves, because they're giving out loans that can't be forgiven, which is unprecedented in human history, by the way. And it's also anti-biblical. This idea of jubilee, of forgiveness of debt, because debt is viewed as something that's very bad. It's debt and slavery are very, very much intertwined. If you're in debt, your labor is not your own. And that is a form of slavery. It's not, you know, it's not as bad as, you know, very literal slavery, but it is a form of it. It's very negative thing. And it sucks. It absolutely sucks. And the incentive structures that they've created, and they being the people that run the country, control the money, all of these things, promotes more of it. And they're self-replicating. There's a feedback loop, like you were talking about earlier. There's a feedback loop of these actions resulting in more and more of it, because now the incentives are in line with people's very real benefits that they receive for being a part of it. Like Ibram X. Kendi, his real name is like, what, Henry something? But yeah, that guy is making millions of dollars on speaking fees. So of course he's going to continue to say that everything's racist, because he makes money off of saying that everything's racist. So everything is racist, including drinking milk.
Okay.
Cleveland, let's end this on a positive note. Tell me about the specifics of the program, what you offer, and we talked about some of the benefits of it, but you know, whatever you can say in the in a quick form.
Yeah, absolutely. So the big offer I have to kind of guys in our space is the Axios Training Club. And what it is, it's a community training group. Everyone will have a different program. I have a variety of different programs that you can have access to, different goals in mind, different equipment setups, different time constraints. But fundamentally, it gives you a spot to have a structured program. You get the guidance and camaraderie of the group. But then you also get the opportunity to work kind of within those bounds and share the efforts of your work and get benefit of seeing other guys work towards their specific goals. So there's plenty of room, no matter what your skill level or what your specific condition is now. If you take the survey, I'm sure Sam will link it somewhere within the show notes here. If you just take that survey, that is enough for me to know to make a connection with you. And then we can start the process of seeing if you're going to be a good fit for the club.
Absolutely. Okay. And then there's, you offer other stuff on there, but you'll talk to people about that specifically when they sign up, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. If there's needs for anything more than that, we can look through that. But the big one is the club. A lot of people will start with the club and then maybe grow from there. But just joining up with that community, getting access to a program and starting kind of this next phase is really just a big opportunity for anyone looking for something that's more than what Modernity has to offer.
Got it. And how much is that?
It's $50. It's $50 for an activation fee. So you get 6 weeks out the gate for $50. And then to continue on, it's $25 a month after that. So very
Fantastic.
Affordable rates. Yeah.
Trying well to make worth this it. Something
that, yeah.
The benefits that you'll have are far reaching beyond that. And you'll get to be in a private club that encourages fitness with a great group of guys. I'm active in the Telegram almost every single day. You'll be in there with me, JD, Jay Burden, and Meta Prime and a bunch of other guys. I know a lot of the people that listen are fans of them. So that's a draw as well. But yeah, thank you so much for your time, JD. I'll reach out and all those links will be down below. Follow JD on Twitter as well. And thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you for having me, Sam. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you for coming here. And remember, you are human.
The curses of modernity. What most guys really need is structure, intention, and community. No, one of the big core missions we have is to kind of push back against the atomization. Part of the biggest aspects of fragility is being atomized and alone, what the long-term play is and how we are going to see it through to the other side. Mental health services, which are a complete grift psychologically, is resulting in a bunch of dysfunctional individuals. The guidance and camaraderie of the group,